Hello, this is Derek Frost from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. Today's program is generously underwritten by Brian Lee Funeral Homes, located in Raleigh, Garner, and Anger. They can be reached at 919-832-8225. They believe every life is unique and deserves to be honored so that every funeral is as unique and special as the person it represents. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the headline, 2019 Leaders in Diversity. There is a great deal of discussion about equality and inclusion at workplaces, but these 17 individuals and companies are doing more than talk through hard work and new initiatives. Also, former 4th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals Judge Allison Duncan is honored for her career. And we start with the Lifetime Achievement Award given to Allison K. Duncan. Title, former judge, U.S. Court of Appeals for the 4th Circuit, birthplace, Durham. Family, husband, William Webb, son, Charles. Education, B.A., Hampton University, J.D., Duke University. Judge Allison K. Duncan is officially retired from her seat on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 4th Circuit, but she doesn't plan on switching off her drive for personal growth anytime soon. I have to work every day to be good, the Durham native says. I'm never really satisfied with where I am. I'm not sure it's ever switched off. Duncan has had first attached to her name multiple times throughout her accomplished career. She was the first African-American woman to sit on the 4th Circuit bench. She was also the first African-American president of the NC Bar Association, as well as the first black woman to serve as a justice on the North Carolina Court of Appeals. Duncan, speaking about the positive influence of diversity, painted a picture of a courtroom jury. We bring together 12 people from all strata of society, all backgrounds, and we throw at them the toughest, most technical legal challenges that there are to be decided. And they do a remarkably good job, she says. But that's diversity. That's the cumulative value of that collective wisdom. Duncan's interest in law developed at a young age. Her mother, Anne, worked at NC Central University, where she was a law librarian and also taught legal research and writing. Duncan spent much of her younger years passing time in the law library, and in high school she would type papers for law students. Duncan earned her undergraduate degree at Hampton University and studied law at Duke University, graduating in 1975. Early in her career, she was an attorney for the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. She has served as an NC Utilities Commissioner and worked at a private law practice in Raleigh. She also taught law at NCCU. In 2003, President George W. Bush nominated Duncan to the 4th Circuit, and the Senate confirmed her by a vote of 93-0. She served on the bench for 15 years before announcing in 2018 her plans to retire. She officially retired at the end of July after earning senior judge status. During her time on the 4th Circuit, she made it a priority to select a diverse group of law clerks each year. I absolutely want a wealth of background and experience, she says, adding she wanted to be challenged during the reviewing and drafting of court opinions. What's the greatest good and the least harm we can do here? Duncan says about how she approached her role as a judge. I would rather do less and risk less harm than do more with a greater prospect of collateral damage that I hadn't foreseen. In 2011, Duncan was appointed to the Duke Board of Trustees, and she also serves as the vice president with the International Association of Judges, a role that takes her around the world promoting the rule of law and the independence of the judiciary. How did you contribute to your organization's diversity and inclusive mission? I was the first woman and the first African American from North Carolina to be appointed to that court. In that capacity, I have reached out to and mentored a number of young women and people of color, both within the judiciary and in the profession as a whole. What are some of the biggest accomplishments by you and your company in the past year in the field of diversity and inclusion? As the federal courts have become more diverse, they have also become more sensitive to the issues and challenges presented in an increasingly diverse climate and have begun to address them proactively. What are the greatest challenges or obstacles in implementing a diversity and inclusive policy in any organization? One is ensuring the presence of diverse candidates in the pipeline. Another is constantly being on guard against inertia. Whom do you consider a mentor? In addition to my mother, my greatest mentor was the Honorable Julia Cooper Mack, the judge for whom I clerked on the District of Columbia Court of Appeals. She was the first woman of color to hold that position. When I was sworn in as a judge, she participated in the ceremony and helped me put on my robe. Where do you see the best example of diversity and inclusion advancing in the Triangle, and what is your most rewarding volunteer experience? I place these two questions together because the responses overlap. My most rewarding volunteer experience has been my service on the Duke University Board of Trustees because of the community with which I have been able to interact. I am sure that the same story can be told across the triangle, but I believe that the college and university environment can be the perfect culture for inculcating the values of diversity from the student body and faculty to the parents and alumni. And in the individual category, we read about Regina Evans of NetApp, title FPVR Help Desk Manager, birthplace Baltimore, family husband Anthony, son Josiah, and daughter Sarah, education BA Business Management, NC State University, MBA Technology Management, Walden University, company description Hybrid Cloud Data Services and Data Management. How did you contribute to your organization's diversity and inclusive mission? I got involved early on in our global diversity and inclusion initiatives by becoming a part of the leadership team's discussions around creating a culture of diversity, inclusion, and belonging. I enjoy the privilege of serving as the secretary and treasurer of our NetApp network of Blacks in Tech, working with women in technology to help in the community through Dress for Success, Chick Tech, and other initiatives to help broaden diversity. I also partner with NetApp's recruiting to help build a more diverse workforce pipeline by going out to local universities to help with recruiting. What are some of the biggest accomplishments by you and your company in the past year in the field of diversity and inclusion? NetApp received an award from Hispanic Association of Colleges and Universities, as well as an award from Advancing Minorities in Engineering. They have invested in professional development for women by sponsoring such events as Women of Color and the Black Engineer of the Year conferences. I have worked over the past year to help mentor ladies of all ages as they pursue their career goals. I also worked with Dress for Success, Operation Dignity, and other groups to help women to grow and improve their quality of life. What are the greatest challenges or obstacles in implementing a diversity and inclusive policy in any organization? Helping people to recognize and overcome their own biases that may hinder them from being able to embrace a culture where diversity is not only welcome, but also allows for both personal and corporate team growth. When we realize that everyone has value and we each bring a level of expertise and knowledge to the table, it's then when we can do our best thinking and develop solutions that can impact the world in which we live. Whom do you consider a mentor? Kathy Coencas. She is my manager at NetApp, and she has been a mentor who has truly shown that she cares about the success of others. She seeks to understand people rather than to be understood. Where do you see the best example of diversity and inclusion advancing in the triangle? NetApp and companies like NetApp, where individuals are not only expected to be high-performing in the workplace, but also in their community. What does the Triangle need to do to have a vibrant atmosphere for a thriving, diverse, and inclusive workforce across all sectors? The Triangle must provide a venue where people can come together and have a place to share a diverse set of ideas and solutions to the difficult problems that need to be addressed. It must be a place where different schools of thought are welcomed and people are not criticized simply because they have a different point of view. What is your most rewarding volunteer experience? Working with the students at Poe Elementary in Durham, when I interact with them, I am reminded of how bright the future can be if we all take time to sow positive seeds into the lives of our youth. And in the company category, we'll read about the Great Raleigh Trolley. CEO Zach Medford, total number of employees 15, year founded 2017, company description trolley tours throughout the triangle. What are some of the most notable accomplishments by your company in the past year in the field of diversity and inclusion? In hiring Heather Lee, an expert historian and local writer for ABC 11 and Candid Slice, we had the opportunity to make great strides toward diversity and inclusion. Heather has designed many incredible local tours that serve to impart the volumes of local knowledge she has obtained as a fifth-generation Raleighite. We now offer tours on African-American history, LGBTQIA plus history, cemetery and paranormal history, and many other concepts. People want to hear the stories they were never taught in school, and Heather's bold storytelling and intimate historical knowledge sheds light on our diverse past. What are the greatest challenges or obstacles in implementing a diversity and inclusive policy in an organization? We hire tour guides based on their diverse backgrounds and experience. We encourage them to develop their own tour based on their unique interests and personal experiences. With working alongside people with such different backgrounds, working styles can sometimes clash, and it can be difficult to create a tour that everyone feels passionate about while also staying unique. We have also faced obstacles in finding reputable historical facts on Raleigh, since so much of the history seems to have been covered up or forgotten. What does the Triangle need to do to have a vibrant atmosphere for a thriving, diverse, and inclusive workforce across all sectors? Diversity should be a goal to work toward instead of a problem that needs to be managed or something to be afraid of. We believe in building the Triangle for everyone and not just for a select few that happen to be able to afford it. What percentage of your employee base are women, people of color, and part of the LGBTQ community? Our company is 50% women, 30% people of color, and 20% LGBTQ. What percentage of your executive team are women, people of color, and part of the LGBTQ community? Our executive team is 66% women and 33% people of color. And now we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle Happenings, written by managing editor Dane Huffman. Member of holding family sells bank stock. If you thought Raleigh's First Citizens is a closely held public company, here's another nugget that shows the public may be having less say in the future. That's because the bank is buying back more shares from the open market. On September 23, via a securities filing, First Citizens disclosed that it had purchased 50,000 shares of its outstanding Class A common stock from Ella Ann Holding, the widow of former Executive Vice Chairman Frank B. Holding and the mother of CEO Frank B. Holding Jr., and Hope Bryant, current vice chairwoman. The repurchase comes out of a previous board decision to authorize the purchase of up to 800,000 shares on the open market or in private transactions from July 1, 2019 through June 30, 2020. The board also approved the repurchase of up to 250,000 shares held by Ella Ann Holding before April 30, 2020. The transaction was funded through cash reserves, according to the bank. By the way, the bank stock was trading at $481 on September 25, up from $377 at the end of 2018. The bank has a market capitalization of nearly $5.3 billion. Dilapidated hotel site may finally get new life. Given the startling growth in Raleigh, it's stunning to drive down Capitol Boulevard and see an abandoned hotel with rusting structures and weeds. That might be finally about to change. An Arizona-based real estate developer has applied to rezone the site of the Capitol Plaza Hotel to allow for commercial mixed-use development with green frontage. Alliance Residential Company says the rezoning would allow for the redevelopment of an underutilized site at a prominent location, as well as for significant additional housing in an area of high demand. Additionally, the new zoning would let site changes be made, allowing for new proposed connecting roads and improved access or for area public transit. The property is owned by Fayetteville's Balbier Bill Brar, who acquired it through an auction in 2011 for $1.4 million. He had said at the time that he planned to renovate the rooms and reopen it as a hotel. There's more change, surprise, for UNC System. Change is the new norm at the University of North Carolina system. Just 24 hours after Board of Governors Chair Harry Smith announced his resignation, the system's interim president, Dr. Bill Roper, said he will depart after June 30. Roper, 70, took the reins following the sudden resignation of former President Margaret Spellings. At the time, Roper was serving as the CEO of UNC Healthcare. Spellings served as president for only 3 years, the shortest tenure of anyone at the overall head of the university system since Solomon Poole lost his job after 2 years in 1871, when the deteriorating university was closed. Makes Bill Friday's 30-year run seem even more remarkable, right? Fido keeps adding amenities for trips to veterinarian. Services for pets continue to move upscale as a new pet hospital headed to Raleigh shows. Oak Heart Veterinary Hospital by Greg Nyme and Vets Pets is opening its third Raleigh location at 1600 South Saunders Street next month. The 10,000-square-foot location includes a veterinary hospital, a retail shop, and a resort with a dog daycare facility, and kennels for boarding cats and dogs. Builders included pet-friendly softer floors and an energy-efficient HVAC system, noise-controlling compartments, and more. Nyme says the goal was a modern and innovative facility. Raleigh PR firm owner plays producer role in new film. Raleigh marketing executive Rick French is continuing to make his mark in film, serving as executive producer on a new film that will be an updated look at the classic Don Quixote. The True Don Quixote opens in New York this weekend and has its digital release October 1. The film stars Tim Blake Nelson and was written and directed by Chris Pache, spelled P-O-C-H-E. The film, shot primarily outside New Orleans, is about a deluded man who believes he's a 14th century knight and must bring chivalry back to the world. And finally, bluegrass music comes to the airport again. You may have heard some unusual noises at Raleigh-Durham International Airport this week. That's because RDU, as has become tradition, has its own way to celebrate the wide-open Bluegrass Festival, happening through September 28 in Raleigh. And now we turn to the On Banking, Transportation, and Tech page written by Lauren Onasorge. Execs clash with RDU over general aviation parking. As passenger numbers rise, Raleigh-Durham International Airport may take back a parking lot near its general aviation terminal to use for general public parking, but the proposed plan faces harsh criticism from some companies. There has to be a solution, says Ashley Smith, president of Jet Logistics, but what's frustrating is no one is willing to discuss it. Fixed-based operators Signature Air and TAC Air will get a 2 weeks notice from RDU before it becomes official. The fixed-based operators say via a letter to their tenants obtained by Triangle Business Journal, they've been given a tentative move-out date of October 1, though RDU representatives say nothing is final. If the change happens, there are paid parking options available, but most employees whose firms rely on general aviation would likely move to an off-site parking lot and be shuttled to the terminal. For Jet Logistics, which contracts with UNC AirCare on emergency services, it's time its patients can't always afford. When we have an issue, we're trying to get the patient as quick as we can, Smith says. That extra 10 to 15 minutes waiting on a bus makes a huge difference. Trey Walter, CEO of Tenant Flight School Blue Line Aviation, says complications like this are why he's moving the headquarters of his operation out of RDU and to Johnston County. RDU claims rising traffic numbers have left it with few options. RDU has allowed tenants and employees of TAC Air and Signature to park in the lot because those spaces were not needed for commercial parking operations, a spokeswoman writes. General aviation staff and customers who park in these spaces pay significantly less than the market rate, which contributes to the approximately $2.5 million annual subsidy RDU pays for general aviation operations. First Citizens Bank to buy Georgia Bank. First Citizens Bank and Trust Company is buying another out-of-state community bank for a cash consideration of more than $2.3 million to its shareholders. The $37 billion asset Raleigh Bank is acquiring $223 million asset Community Financial, which offers deposit and loan services through its banking subsidiary, Gwinnett Community Bank. Community Financial is based in Duluth, Georgia. This is a logical extension of recent First Citizens acquisitions, boosting the company's presence down I-85 and I-985 in South Carolina, Georgia, and more specifically in Metro Atlanta, says Lee Burrows, industry watcher and founder of Bank Street Partners, in an email. Other recent First Citizens deals? Integra Financial, a $1.7 billion asset bank with 18 offices and two loan production offices throughout Western North Carolina, Upstate South Carolina, and North Georgia. This has been approved by shareholders, but not closed. First South Bank shares, a $237 million asset bank with four branches and a loan production office in South Carolina. Biscayne Bank shares, a $990 million asset bank with four branches in Florida. Palmetto Heritage Bank shares, a $164.9 million asset bank with three branches in South Carolina. And Capital Commerce Bancorp, or Securant, a $226 million asset bank with four branches in Wisconsin. Grant lures new Cree plant to New York. As it works to build its semiconductor capacity, Durham-based Cree is expanding again, this time in New York. Cree CEO Greg Lowe says that while the company is still investing $500 million into its Durham site to expand its materials production, a wafer manufacturing facility originally planned for the Triangle is now going to happen instead near Utica, New York. The new plan allows Cree to create a factory that's 25% larger than we could have here and for actually less money, he says. The materials factory plans in Durham haven't downsized. In fact, it's probably going to be larger based on the interest we're seeing in the electric vehicle industry, Lowe says. The factory that we were planning to use as a wafer fab here will actually be a second materials factory for us. According to a news release, it means a $1 billion investment in construction equipment and other related costs to be facilitated by a grant from New York State worth $500 million. How the state lured policy genius. Despite heavy competition from Pittsburgh, Durham inked a big win with Policy Genius, a New York-based online insurance broker that recently committed to bringing 377 jobs to a new downtown operation. But 240 pages of communications, applications, and other documents showed the extra caution state officials applied when it came to the incentives package because Policy Genius is a startup. Within weeks of the official announcement in Durham, the company told the state via its incentives application that it was completing additional applications for more than $3 million worth of incentives to locate in the Pittsburgh area instead. According to a brief included in the records, the Pittsburgh region provides access to labor at wages estimated to be between 1 to 2% below those in Durham. CEO Jennifer Fitzgerald would say it was largely the Triangle's university and college-fueled talent pool that tipped the scales. The state had special contingencies for Policy Genius for its $5 million in incentives. Because it's a startup, staff recommended that in addition to meeting investment and job milestones, the firm be required to submit audited financial statements for the first 3 years to receive the promised grant dollars. The financials have to reflect positive cash flow, a debt-to-net worth ratio of not less than 1-to-1, and there can't be any statement reflecting an ongoing concern. Also, Policy Genius must create at least 339 jobs, including at least 252 in the first year of the agreement, listed as 2021. And finally, in a section called She Said It, the pedestal on which women are thought to stand too often turns out to be a cage, and opening their eyes to that reality was the challenge. One of my efforts was to try to get them to think of what they would like the world to be for their daughters and granddaughters. That's Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Supreme Court Justice, speaking at Mamandi Concert Hall in Raleigh at a Meredith College event, September 23. And now we turn to the page written by Seth Thomas Gulledge on healthcare and education. Tired UNC System Chair to resign. UNC System Board of Governors Chairman Harry Smith says he's stepping down from his position because he believes the timing is right for a new suite of leadership over the system, and he is tired of the daily demands and politics of the position. Long a target of criticism throughout the state for his role as chair, Smith will step down as chair October 1, but will remain a member of the board. Smith says he will be focusing on his private equity firm that he launched 3 months ago. Smith is the former chair and CEO of Flanders Corporation. He joined the board in 2013 and has been its chairman for just over 1 year. Vice Chair Randall Ramsey, who owns a boat building business in Beaufort, will head the board as it begins to look for new leadership. Asked why he decided to suddenly resign, Smith says he has been in conversations for 6 months over the timing of his resignation. He says the decision now is just timing as the board looks for a new system president to replace Dr. Bill Roper, who is serving in the interim since former President Margaret Spellings resigned at the end of 2018. This is the right thing. It allows continuity and allows the board to get somebody in place, Smith says. So whoever we hire knows who the chairman is going to be. I think that's the right thing. He says his motivation for resigning is based on the demands of the system, especially following a long line of controversies in recent years, including the sudden ouster of UNC Chancellor Carol Folt after her decision to remove a Confederate statue in the midst of ongoing protests irked some of the system's some on the system's board of governors. The UNC system comes at you every day, he says. It's not just policy, it's hurricanes, Silent Sam, school shootings, it's all that. I'm not a bureaucrat, I'm not a politician, I'm just a workhorse, I'm not a show horse. I'm pretty tired right now. It's the board politics, the system politics, and the Raleigh politics, he says. CRO says strategy is reaping major growth this year. While the Triangle has seen the rise of several massive contract research organizations, or CROs, one Morrisville-based outfit has entered a period of rapid growth that it counts as the result of a successful strategy targeting early-stage drug makers. According to Peter Benton, president and chief operating officer of Worldwide Clinical Trials, the company has seen a dramatic explosion in new business as a good economy and scientific breakthroughs play into the company's strategy. Our growth rate is very significant because of the amount of wins we've had this year, he says. We're on target to see close to 50% top-line growth in new business awards, which is way, way above the market average. He says the company has long been focused on early to mid-sized biotech and pharmaceutical companies, favoring contracts with companies beyond the proof-of-concept testing traditionally related to government funding, but below the threshold at which massive CROs dominate. Essentially, he says those companies are studies are funded by private dollars, something that has been in increasing abundance due to new technology in a positive economy. UNC breakthrough could help patients with HIV. A breakthrough coming out of UNC Chapel Hill could radically improve the lives and treatment adherence for HIV patients, and researchers also believe it may be the first step in developing similar breakthroughs for other diseases. In a new study published in Nature Communications, UNC researchers have demonstrated the effectiveness of an injectable multi-drug delivery system that could replace the daily pill regimen for HIV patients. Rahima Benharber, first author of the study and an assistant professor of biomedical engineering, a joint program between UNC and NC State University, says the impact of the system could be life-changing for patients across the globe. To have a treatment that can be administered once and not have to be readministered every day, that's a major impact, she says. The system is an implant injected into patients, and it is both biodegradable and removable after implementation. In practice, Benharber says it could last for up to a year for patients, but even having to get the injection twice a year would be a profound improvement over a daily regimen. She says there is another drug going through the approval process that could act as a long-term resource for patients, but added that it cannot deliver a multi-drug solution. And finally, Blue Cross NC CEO steps down amid controversy over DWI arrest. Dr. Patrick Conway has resigned as CEO of Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina in the wake of his arrest for DWI earlier this year. The company's board of trustees has decided he should step down, a reversal of its initial stance to retain him. The decision comes after news that Conway was arrested in June on charges of driving while impaired and misdemeanor child abuse following an accident on Interstate 85 in Randolph County. At the time of the incident, Conway's young daughters were in the vehicle. The company has endured growing pressure against Conway, including North Carolina Department of Insurance Commissioner Mike Causey, calling for his resignation. On September 24, it was announced BCBSNC's $16 billion venture with Oregon-based Cambia Health Solutions could be in jeopardy. Initially following news of Conway's June arrest, Blue Cross NC issued a release saying its board had decided that Patrick's strong leadership will continue to be an asset. But then the board decided to ask for Conway's resignation based on new details. New details have come to light, particularly notes from the arresting officers and contents from their investigative files of which the board was unaware, the company stated. According to the release, Conway immediately accepted the call for his resignation. In his place, Gerald Petkow, the company's chief operating officer, will serve as interim CEO. Conway, who refused a breathalyzer test on the date of the incident, is scheduled to appear in court October 8. And now we turn to the On Real Estate page, written by Caleb Harshberger. Construction starts on $108 million tower in downtown. A Baltimore-based developer has announced the start of construction on the second phase of a major mixed-use development in downtown Raleigh after securing the necessary funding earlier this month. Heritage Properties announced September 23 that it closed on a $73 million loan from M&T Bank and BB&T to build Tower 2 at Block 83, the sister tower to One Glenwood. Tower 2 is a $108 million project and will be about the same size as One Glenwood, with plans calling for a 10-story Class A office building totaling 271,500 square feet, including retail totaling 30,000 square feet, and a 665-space parking garage. The Whitting Turner Contracting Company has begun construction. The environment we are creating between One Glenwood and Tower 2 will be the first of its kind for the city, says Ryan Blair, vice president and partner at Heritage Properties. The combination of street-level amenities and modern office design will truly be special and offer tenants and their employees a lifestyle that is much more than a traditional office development. Tower 2 will also feature a tenant lounge and terrace overlooking Hillsborough Street, and the courtyard between the two towers is slated to have a coffee shop built out of a shipping container, a concert stage, and a turf lawn for yoga. The project is expected to be completed in early 2021. The project team for Tower 2 includes Gensler Raleigh as lead architect, Trinity Partners, McAdams Engineering, Kimley Horn, Barrett Woodyard, Lynch Merkins, Surface 678, and Whiting Turner Construction Company. William Allen and Alex Dunn of Trinity Partners oversee leasing for the office space, and Charlie Coyne and Reagan Crabtree of CBRE Raleigh handle retail leasing. Heritage Properties also announced the company had closed an $80 million refinancing of One Glenwood, signaling its commitment to maintaining its ownership of the property in the years to come. Raleigh firm building new 42-acre business park in Apex. A Raleigh real estate firm with offices in New York has begun building a 40-plus acre multi-building business park in Apex with one phase down and two to go. Greenhawk Corporation has begun marketing space in the upcoming Peak City Business Park, a 14-building office park featuring 250,000 square feet of office and flex space. The park is situated on 42 acres at 2041 Energy Drive in Apex, off US 1, and pre-leasing has already begun. Marketing materials show plans calling for 103,000 square feet of office space, 110,000 square feet of office flex space, and 17,000 square feet of retail. The first phase has already been completed and leased, featuring 60,000 square feet spread out over four buildings. Greenhawk expects the second phase, 140,000 square feet over five buildings, to be completed by the end of the year. The final phase, 100,000 square feet over five buildings, is expected to be finished by late 2020. Rates will vary based on tenant, building, and lease size. Rates will be between $17 to $25 per square foot. Vaibhav Dhawan of Greenhawk says the company bought the property in 2007 but shelved its plans due to the financial crisis. Greenhawk paid $2.7 million for the property in 2007, according to county records. The park is another win for the town of Apex, which has seen rapid growth over the years and has begun working to attract new businesses and commercial investment in the town. Work to begin on mixed-use project near RTP with a contemporary feel. A burgeoning real estate firm in Durham, run by Duke University alumni, is set to begin work on a mixed-use development near Research Triangle Park. Durham-based Abra Nova Real Estate will begin work next month on the $27.4 million Nova RTP. Plans for the project call for more than 9,000 square feet of co-working space, 37 apartments, 46 smart townhomes, office space, as well as conference rooms, a shared events kitchen, gym and yoga room, a pool, and walking trails. The development will be located at 2801 Courtney Creek Boulevard. Abra Nova founder and CEO Abraham Negwani says the new community will be a unique contemporary project. "It's really out of the box for a place like Durham," Negwani says. "We believe that a lot of people are looking for contemporary real estate but can't find it." The first phase includes townhomes, which will start in the $400,000 range. Buyers can then add technology packages, including options such as smart appliances, solar power, and electric car charging stations. Units average around 2,300 square feet, and the first batch of about 25 will be completed by summer 2020. Phase two will feature 36 apartments, office space, and a coffee shop. Weaver Street Market opens in downtown Raleigh. A local nonprofit grocer has marked its expansion into Wake County with the opening of a location in Raleigh's Warehouse District. Weaver Street Market opened its Raleigh store September 23. The new store features 12,600 square feet of grocery and dining space located at the Dillon. General Manager Ruffin Slater says it will be the first of several stores the grocery chain hopes to bring to the county, and the success of this location will determine much of what's to come. "As this store proves itself, we'll want to look at more locations in Raleigh. It seems like a good fit," he says. "I think within 6 months we'll know. Already in 2 days we know a lot." Slater says Weaver Street will be looking for more space in the denser parts of the city. Two communities, 1,600 homes, proposed for Sanford. Two proposed projects would bring more than 1,600 homes plus retail space to Sanford. The town has received two rezoning requests for a pair of master planned communities dubbed Galvin Ridge and Laurel Oaks. Both plans were filed by Withers Ravenel, and home building giant DR Homes appears to be the home builder for both projects. Galvin Ridge, situated on 533 acres at the corner of U.S. Highway 1 and Cologne Road, Galvin Ridge is a proposed 995-unit community with a mix of townhomes and single-family homes across four phases. And Laurel Oaks is a proposed 624-unit community on Commerce Drive near the intersection with NC Highway 87. Lots will feature a mix of townhomes and single-family homes across 210 acres. Christensen finalizes new trifecta with Raleigh location for eatery. That's the headline on the first story on the On Restaurants and Retail page written by Dathan Kazik. The much-anticipated third location of Ashley Christensen and MDO Holdings' Project Extra Crispy has been announced. The fast casual restaurant's third spot will be inside the new Midtown East Shopping Center off Wake Forest Road. Midtown East is situated between Costco and Trader Joe's and will be part of the Wegmans Shopping Center. Midtown East was definitely on the top of our list due to its easy accessibility to many parts of Raleigh, Christensen says. We just had to make sure we could secure a space that worked for us and work out the details of the lease. The name and menu are being kept under wraps for now. The restaurant will have approximately 100 seats and will employ about 50 people. When the restaurant opens, expect more pickles. Christensen and MDO Holdings polled people about what makes the best fried chicken sandwich, and many of the responses pertain to pickles. "We're excited to have an option to super pickle your sandwich, which will mean extra pickles and pickle juice mayo," she says. This will be the first of the Project Extra Crispy restaurants to open in the Triangle. Previously, Christensen and MDO Holdings announced locations coming to Durham's University Hill and Cary's Parkside Town Commons. Christensen expects to have the Midtown East location open in the spring of 2020, with University Hill to follow and the Parkside Town Commons to open next fall. Christensen is the owner of AC Restaurants, which includes Raleigh Eateries, Pool's Diner, Beasley's Chicken and Honey, Chuck's, Fox Liquor, Beer, and Death in Taxes. Raleigh Chef joins effort to celebrate American food. A celebrated Raleigh chef is getting a boost from an unexpected source. Oscar Diaz, who runs the Cortez on Glenwood Avenue, will be part of Walmart's Rediscovering America program designed to show the importance of local produce around the United States. Last year, the mega retailer paired with five chefs from around the country. This year, Walmart is involving a total of 9 James Beard-nominated chefs, including Diaz. Walmart was looking for restaurants to be a part of the program, and they were really looking for a celebrated chef who had some recognition and also had a philosophy that matches what they were looking for in the program, he says. For Walmart's program, Diaz wanted to make his one-of-a-kind meal something close to home. I remember my parents going to the grocery store and getting produce that they'd cook directly on the charcoal, he recalls. I'm trying to tap into that, something very simple but very important. In teaming up with the James Beard Foundation, Walmart will be giving away 10 scholarships worth $10,000 to women of color to pursue careers in the culinary arts. Diaz has been a part of the Raleigh food scene for the past 8 years, along with his business partner, Charlie Ibarra, who together also owned the successful Mexican restaurant Jose & Sons in Raleigh. Before coming to Raleigh, Diaz worked out west, including in Las Vegas. Charlotte's largest brewery eyes Triangle distribution. The Old Mecklenburg Brewery has paired up with distributor Tryon Distributing to bring some of its award-winning ales and lagers to the Triangle. This marks the first time the brewery has expanded distribution since the passing of the Craft Beer Distribution and Modernization Act, which allows breweries an opportunity to offer beverages through a distributor without sacrificing its self-distribution. It's a win-win for everyone, says John Marino, founder of OMB. Not only does it benefit our homegrown brewer manufacturers, but also our North Carolina-based distributors and local retailers. OMB will be bringing beers such as its flagship Cooper Ale to 19 counties in central North Carolina. We're excited to add OMB to our strong craft beer portfolio in central North Carolina, says Brad Johnston, owner of Tryon Distributing. And finally, Apps for Beer Drinkers celebrates Raleigh's thirst for craft beer. Untapped, an app for beer drinkers, has almost completed its 7-city tour of the most checked-in cities for the month of August, and Raleigh found its name on the list. To celebrate, Untapped co-founder Greg Avola visited the tap room of Burial Beer Company inside the food transfer hall in Raleigh for an afternoon of beer, exclusive swag, and prizes. Raleigh joined an elite crowd in August, joining San Diego, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, Washington, D.C., Pittsburgh, Richmond, Virginia, and Denver. And now we turn to the Viewpoint page in the Triangle Business Journal to read the editor's notebook written by Sugata Mukherjee, editor of the Triangle Business Journal. The headline, Raleigh Mayoral Elections Should Matter to All. We have been covering business for a long time in this area. American City Business Journals, Triangle Business Journal's parent company, bought the paper in 1991, and ever since we have tried to inform our subscribers about the most important business stories they need to read, understand, and perhaps analyze for the impact on their business. Looking through that prism of impact and relevance, I think this year's mayoral race in Raleigh is extremely important because it may set new rules of engagement between government and business for years to come. So, in the past few days, TBJ and CBS 17 joined hands to sit down and talk to all the 6 candidates about pressing business issues surrounding housing affordability, incentives, and job creation methods. You can visit our website and listen to the entire interviews with the candidates. Frontrunners Marianne Baldwin, Charles Francis, and Caroline Sullivan all use their standard talking points about what they will do to spur economic development in the city. And frankly, none of them were really eye-opening. That may be because the economic track record of Raleigh has been pretty strong and sustained over the past few years. Predictably, the other 3 candidates, Zene Balak, George Knott, and Justin Sutton, were more aggressive in their plan to level the playing field for Raleigh citizens who may not be able to afford a $2,500 a month apartment downtown. They really don't want to offer incentives to developers, and if the city considers such a program, they want strict measures and restrictions with a goal to bring affordability. Baldwin talked about her role in helping expand specific companies such as Citrix and Pendo, while Francis reiterated his point about him being the only person in the race who actually owns and runs a business. Sullivan came across as being somewhat wonky, but in a good way. She talked about the possible use of tax increment financing, or TIFs, to support initiatives such as the Downtown South Project. In 2004, North Carolina voters approved a constitutional amendment meant to push forward the TIF financing, also known as project development financing. So far, only two deals were done through TIF, the Carolina Crossroads Project in Roanoke Rapids, and a Buncombe County initiative to finance some $13 million of works in the town of Woodfin, located near Asheville. The Roanoke Rapids project was a disaster, and the taxable property value required to pay down the $13 million debt in Woodfin is way below projections. And therein lies the dilemma, whether TIF actually works without adding risk for the taxpayer. Sullivan and Baldwin say we need several parties, including the NC Housing and Finance Agency, nonprofits in the housing sector, and the developers, to sit at one table and come up with solutions to address affordability. Francis says Raleigh must expand its program for the homeless, take people out of hotels on Capitol Boulevard, and put them in apartments. To me, all these options brought forward by the candidates clearly need additional vetting, but at least the candidates are talking about it. In the end, you need money to implement new programs. The question is, where will that money come from? Do you cut your other programs to shift dollars? Do you tax the business community more to pay for the new services? Or perhaps you borrow against the future growth of the city, which right now may not be a bad idea with almost 50 new people moving into the city every day. But no one knows what may happen in 2020 and beyond. There's another caveat to all this. All seven seats on the city council are up for grabs. If a mayor cannot get along with the majority of the city council, his or her effectiveness to lead a city is vastly diminished. There are seven spots, two at-large seats, and 21 contenders to fill up the council table. Lawyers and business folks who have donated money to the mayoral race indicate many of the races are very tight and it may come down to a handful of votes in the end. Local elections always come down to a handful of votes. If you can get your neighbor and his neighbor and the guy you play your Monday night poker with to vote, you're likely going to win. As the Chinese proverb goes, we live in interesting times. It's about to get a whole lot more interesting in about 10 days. And also on the Viewpoint page, we have a guest opinion written by Smedes York, who is the former mayor of Raleigh, a former board member of the Raleigh-Durham Airport Authority, and he's currently chair of the McDonald York Company in Raleigh. The headline, RDU Quarry Should Proceed After Discussion. Both Umstead Park and Raleigh-Durham International Airport are critical to the continued success of our region, but I firmly believe the Wakestone Quarry expansion should proceed. In my experience as a former mayor of Raleigh, it is not uncommon to have community debate surrounding the changes that take place as a community prospers. Rarely is there a new road or project built where some feel that the positives don't outweigh the negatives. There are two valid sides to most arguments. I try hard to understand both sides of an issue. Recently, the Raleigh-Durham Airport Authority entered into a lease with Wakestone to mine 105 acres of land owned by the authority in return for royalties on the sale of crushed stone from the site. The public process that led to this decision spanned 2 years and extensive negotiation between the parties. On balance, I believe the result is positive for our region. First, RDU receives much-needed income to finance its growth. Second, area citizens receive mountain biking trails on an adjoining 150-acre site and ultimately more. I was pleased to see that a proposal was generated to meet both recreational interests and also keep up with the expanding needs of our airport. RDU, because of the strong economy of our area, is one of the fastest-growing airports in the country. The Research Triangle continues to attract talented people and companies in pursuit of that talent. We need a thriving airport. I believe it is clear that final approval of the lease is by the airport authority. It does not require an additional approval by the governing bodies that own the airport, City of Durham, Durham County, City of Raleigh, and Wake County. As a former chair of the airport authority, I appreciate the wisdom shown by the North Carolina General Assembly when it created the organization in 1939. There are 8 board members, 2 appointed by each owner. assuring that there is a direct connection between airport governance and their respective communities, the airport authority voted unanimously to approve the lease. Some concerns have been raised regarding the impact of having a quarry adjacent to Umpstead Park. I believe these concerns can be properly mitigated. I have used the park myself and have driven by the Harrison Avenue entrance often and never noticed the quarry's presence, yet it has been operating there the past 38 years. I have known and respected the Wakestone owners for many years. In addition to being good operators, they have been proactive in protecting and supporting Umpstead Park. They have an exemplary record of both community service and environmental stewardship as they conduct a business essential to our region's growth. We should commend our airport authority for finding an approach that makes responsible fiscal and community use of this land. And now turning to general news in the Triangle Business Journal. New RDU ranking could boost Triangle. And this is written by Lauren Onasorge. Raleigh-Durham International Airport is moving up in the world of airport rankings, something that could mean a boost to the region's economy, perhaps attracting the attention of the next big relocating company. RDU is now a large airport, upgraded from medium in the latest J.D. Power study of North American airports. The airport ranks fifth on the report in terms of passenger satisfaction. J.D. Power also has a mega airport category with 20 airports. Michael Walden, economist and professor at NC State University, says the ranking and the upgrade are a big deal and a major positive for RDU. J.D. Power is well-respected in the industry, he notes in an email. This improved ranking should help with business recruiting, especially for the big fish. And there are a lot of big fish. John Boyd, a site selection expert out of New Jersey, points to one as paint manufacturer Sherwin-Williams, which has publicly disclosed its own search for a new headquarters. Boyd notes that one of the drivers behind its interest in possibly leaving Cleveland is the lack of air service. And he says the timing for J.D. Power's rankings release couldn't be better for North Carolina. I expect this ranking to help catapult Raleigh-Durham into the discussion, Boyd says, pointing to other likely contenders for Sherwin-Williams as Dallas, Atlanta, and Charlotte. Airports are a critical site selection variable, especially for the types of headquarters and regional headquarters Raleigh-Durham is increasingly competing for. Both public records and interviews with executives show the airport is already a major consideration when companies are considering the Triangle for expansions and relocations. Jennifer Fitzgerald, CEO of Policy Genius, said in a recent interview that airport accessibility was essential in her firm's decision to bring 377 jobs to downtown Durham. A few things really stood out, and one was just the proximity and the ease of going back and forth, Fitzgerald said. The airport is great. It's a very easy flight. The logistics piece was important. The J.D. Power North American Airport Satisfaction Study ranks airport customer satisfaction across multiple categories. And now we turn to the column written by James Lee, who's a family business speaker, advisor, and author. The headline, Family Businesses That Survive Through the Years Have Four Vital Characteristics. When I think of all the deep holes that families and business can tumble into, I'm amazed any survive. Current wisdom holds that only about 30% of all family businesses reach the second generation of family ownership, and only half of those make it to the third. One of the early pieces of research on family business I still find useful was done by Professor David Ambrose at the University of Nebraska, Omaha. He found that family-owned firms that survive have four characteristics. They are perceived by family members as financially sound and well-positioned in their industry, and younger family members see the company as being satisfying, even fun, to own and operate. Their surviving family business is likely to be a family affair. The whole family supports the business and is proud to have it carry the family name. The family business that survives into the next generation is most often one that welcomes but never coerces younger family members to join. It's the business that provides training and requires experience before putting family members in management and removes those who aren't competent. The surviving family business is one that enjoys flexible, forward-looking leadership by senior owners who accept and even promote change. Survival prospects improve significantly when executives carry out long-range planning for succession. Out of Ambrose's four cornerstones, my experience spotlights three essential legs of the succession tool: a stable, successful business, a well-managed succession plan, and qualified successors who are welcome but not forced to take on key roles. The stability and profitability of the company are important. Few young people smart enough to run a business will throw away other options to take over one that's headed down the tubes. A solid succession plan is more than a script for a successful transition. A well-drawn plan gives everyone confidence in the continuity of the company. Of course, there's no succession without successors. The better trained and supported the upcoming generation is, the better the chances of successful succession and survival. Global real estate firm comes to Raleigh. A Chicago-based real estate firm with offices around the world is opening its first office in the Triangle with a recently assembled team of local professionals. Vestian has announced it will open a new office in Raleigh, that's spelled V-E-S-T-I-A-N. The company offers everything from cohesive portfolio strategy and management and transaction advisory to corporate finance, project services, workplace integration, data management, facilities management, and more. The new office will be in Imperial Park off Interstate 40 and began operations earlier this month. Vestian, founded in 2010, also operates offices in New York, China, and India. Newly minted Vestian Managing Director Jeremy Dunn will lead the Raleigh team. He previously worked at Credit Suisse, where he served as the head of real estate strategy and executed cost-saving initiatives for a 3.8 million square foot portfolio with an annual occupancy budget of $250 million, according to a recent release. He joined Vestian September 1. "Our diverse team delivers a true business partner-first model to our clients," Dunn says. "Vestian is a place where I can work with colleagues to develop and execute impactful real estate solutions with measurable results for our clients." Also joining the team is Brad Armstrong, who will serve as executive director and will lead the brokerage team in the Carolinas. Armstrong has 23 years of experience in commercial real estate, including 18 at the Equus Corporation. And this article was written by Caleb Harshberger. And we're going to go ahead and stop there as we've run out of time for today's episode of the Triangle Business Journal. I hope you've enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Today's program is generously underwritten by Brian Lee Funeral Homes, located in Raleigh, Garner, and Anger. They can be reached at 919-832-8225. They believe every life is unique and deserves to be honored so that every funeral is as unique and special as the person it represents. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.